This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents A Veil of Spears by Bradley P. Bollier. Performed by Sarah Coombs. Chapter 1. Chaedon knelt in a cavern beside a pool of water, deep beneath the desert's surface. The cavern's darkness enveloped her, as did the chill air. It smelled clean here, unsullied, a place that might have remained hidden throughout all the history of the kings of Sharakai, perhaps longer. In her hands, she held a thick, golden bracelet. She turned it over again and again, feeling its weight, touching the oval stone, roughing her skin against the intricate designs worked into the gold. "Speak to me," she said. "This time speak to me." The echoes went on and on. The bracelet had once belonged to King Misut, the Jackal King, but now it served as an indictment of all the kings, and even of the gods themselves. It was not the band itself that provided evidence of their treachery, but the onyx stone. Even now she could feel the souls of the 17 dead Asirim within it, clamoring for freedom, pleading for their release. Chaedon was desperate to give it to them, but after 6 weeks of trying, she still had no idea how. On the night of the great battle in King's Harbor, Misut had summoned them forth as whites and set them against Chaedon and Sahid Alaz, the king of the 13th tribe, the crowned Asir who had kissed her and set her on this strange new path. It had been a desperate moment, but she had managed to sever Misut's hand and take the golden band from him. She'd pleaded with the ghostly souls to take their revenge against Misut, and they'd answered, descending on Misut like buzzards. Each rake of their terrible claws had brought them exultation, a taste of their long-awaited revenge. But the joy had been short-lived. No sooner had Misut succumbed to his wounds than they had been drawn back into their prison and chained once more. The trick to freeing them had eluded her ever since. "By your grace," Chaedon whispered to the goddess Nalame, cleaving open her mother's flame-shaped locket. She took out the last of her Adhikara petals. Her mouth watered at the floral scent, and when she placed it beneath her tongue, the mineral taste rushed through her. It warmed her limbs, drove away the cold humidity of the cavern in a way that a fire never could. Clipping the locket closed, she breathed deeply, closed her eyes, and welcomed the sensations that came. She felt the Asir, Karim, somewhere high above her. He was outside the cavern, roaming among the rocks, she guessed. He seemed reticent, as if he were hiding his thoughts and emotions from her. He didn't like the bracelet. He had told her so. She could feel the revulsion within him, though whether it was from the constant reminder of his own fate or concern for the souls trapped within, she couldn't say. Opening her mind further, she beckoned the souls nearer. When they retreated, she searched for the onyx's boundaries, tried to define them in some way so that she might learn more about the souls within. But as it had every other time she had done this, the gemstone felt unknowable. A star in the sky, well beyond the ken of mortal man. When she had taken petals in the past, in or near Sharakai, she could always sense the blooming fields and the Asirim below, trapped in their sandy graves. Even now she could feel them, far, far to the west of the cavern, where she and Karim now hid. She'd thought, by using the petals, she would feel the Asyrum in the onyx. She'd hoped to be able to puzzle out its secrets, to use the Asyrum's shared bond to free them from their prison, or failing that, simply speak with them, as she did with Karim. To no avail. She had been rebuffed over and over again. Not once in the weeks following the great battle in King's Harbor had she felt nearer to her goal. "Speak," she said, that lone word echoing in the cave. "But one word, and I'll know this is not a lost cause." Her only reply was a miasma of anguish, fear, confusion, and hatred. The same as always. Her concentration was broken, as it was so often of late, by the growls and yapping of wolves. She was tempted to simply let it go on, but when the sound became more fierce, and she felt panic emanating from Karim, she pulled away from the souls in the bracelet. "Forgive me," she whispered, and rushed up the winding tunnel toward the sun. She was out of breath by the time she reached the cavern's entrance, where, spread before her, in a protective fan, were her pack of maned wolves. They had placed themselves between Karim and the entrance to Chayda's cave. Directly before Karim's crouched form was Mist, a white wolf, hunkered low, ears laid back, teeth barred as a deep growl issued from her throat. She was the very wolf Chayda had stumbled across with Emre on her first trip to the Blooming Fields. The very wolf that had healed Chayda and led her here so she could recover from her wounds and decide what to do next. "Karim," Chayda said as she approached. Karim didn't acknowledge her. He was staring at Mist, his jaundiced eyes wild and nervous, as if he couldn't understand how he had come to be here. His disorientation had been getting worse the longer they hid from the king's forces. "Karim, back away." As she came near, the maned wolves closed ranks, blocking her path. The largest among them, the scared one she had named Thorn, was padding behind Karim. Though the pack tried to stop her, Chayda pushed her way through them, then charged at Thorn, waving her arms as the wolf darted toward Karim, silent, teeth bared.
"Thorn! No!"
Karim turned, arms raised, just in time for Thorn to claw him, to tear at his shriveled, blackened skin. Karim could have killed him with one blow. The Asyrum were inhumanly strong. But he didn't. He backed away, warding off Thorn's advances with arms and hands spread wide. But the danger was far from over. While she had been focused on Thorn, Mist had padded to Chayda's left, clearing a path to Karim.
"Back!"
Chayda cried, putting herself between Karim and the white wolf. Mist's eyes flicked between Karim and Chayda, but she obeyed, and Chayda ran to stop Thorn. Karim wailed, his bloodshot eyes wild with fear. He swung wildly, angrily at Thorn. Chayda heard a thud as Karim's fist struck the wolf's massive head. Thorn was the largest among the wolves. With his long legs, his head was higher than Chayda's, yet he was flung aside by the force of that blow. It brought on a fierce yelp and a renewed fury that drove the entire pack to close in. Their heads were low, growls rumbling from between their bared teeth. They'd listened to Chayda until now, but with Karim's attack on their leader, they were ready to excise this hated member from their pack once and for all. Chayda pulled at Thorn's black mane.
"Leave him alone!"
But Thorn rounded on her and charged. Jaws snapping, he caught her wrist. She managed to snatch her hand away, but caught several deep gashes while doing so. She stumbled backward and fell as Thorn advanced, snapping at her ankles as she tried to kick him. He'd just managed to clamp his jaw over her calf when a blur of ivory flew in. Her leg was freed as Mist and Thorn growled, grappled and rolled in the sand. The other wolves looked on, their eyes intense as they studied the two wolves locked in battle. It grew so fierce, Chayda thought they would kill each other, but when Karim turned and began sprinting over the sand away from them, the wolves finally disengaged. In moments, all their growling and yipping and yowling stopped. They panted, wary but content in Karim's absence. Thorn was the most animated among them, alternating looks between Chayda and Mist, but then he loped off, heading into the shade of the rocky overhang near the cave entrance, where he dropped down and watched, as if daring any to come near and challenge him. Chayda included. Mist padded closer to Chayda and licked the blood welling from her wounds. They immediately felt better, just as her injuries had weeks ago. Mist did the same to the puncture wounds along Chayda's calf, while Chayda raked her fingers through Mist's cloudy mane.
"Thank you," she said,
then limped after Karim. She followed the footsteps and the trail of black blood left over the sand, weaving her way between the sentinel-like pillars of rock. She found him a quarter league away, sitting cross-legged between the dunes, knees hugged to his chest, like a child lost in the desert. She crouched by his side, careful not to touch him, but close enough that he could feel her warmth.
"You don't have to stay."
She waved her arm to the dunes.
"You can go, flee into the desert. Surely somewhere in the Great Mother you might find peace."
She didn't want Karim to go. Not truly. She wanted to free him or, failing that, find a way for him to have his revenge on the kings. And how could she do either of those things if he left? But his misery was so great she had to try. His only response was to swivel his head and stare at her left wrist, where Masut's thick gold band rested. Chayda felt the souls in the onyx gemstone, though muted, as they always were in the sunlight. As if he couldn't bear to think about them any longer, Karim lifted his gaze to meet hers, a silent plea, and then looked to the sword at her side, her ebon blade. She put her hand on the pommel, knowing that he had contemplated this, his final release, since leaving Sharakai.
"I will give it to you, if that's what you wish."
Karim opened his mouth to speak. A long wheeze came out. He swallowed and tried again.
"Ah!"
he said, the lone word coming out in one long rasp.
"I were."
She stood, and with clear intent laid her hand over the leather grip of River's daughter.
"This,"
he nodded. Chayda's heart pounded loud in her ears. She didn't wish to be alone out here, nor did she wish to end a life that might help others to win their freedom. But she meant what she had said. No one deserved a life like Karim's.
"And yet..." "You must say it, Karim." She licked her lips, praying he would say no. "I can't do it unless you say it."
Karim stood, the blackened skin of his forehead wrinkling.
"Aye,"
he said again, but then he turned sharply to his left, and Chayda followed his gaze. Beyond a dozen clutches of standing stones, she saw it. A sleek ship, lateen sails cutting a line across the horizon, A royal yacht, from the looks of it. It was not headed directly toward them, but a crewman atop the vulture's nest might see them at any moment. She crouched, pulling Karim down with her. Her fingers became sticky with the dark, drying blood on his arm. He looked at the blood, lifted his gaze to the ship in the distance, then regarded Chayda once more.
I cannot leave you.
She was tempted to ask if he was certain, only her relief was so great she couldn't find the words.
Come, she told him. We shouldn't linger.
As they headed low and fast toward the cave where the pack had gathered in the shade, she felt Karim's worry growing. He'd managed to resist the king's call thus far, but could he if a maiden were close and summoned him? Or worse, a king? Ahead, mist was digging in the sand, most likely for a lizard to eat or to give to Chayda, but stopped when Chayda came near. Her ears perked and her head lifted. Perhaps sensing worry in Chayda, even as Chayda felt it in Karim, mist returned to the shade of the rocks and lay beside them. A pack once more, they huddled close, while in the distance the yacht drifted across the horizon. It adjusted course once, and Chayda thought they had been spotted, but thank the gods, it merely continued in a straight line. When the sails were nearly lost, Chayda breathed easier, but mist was still tense. She gave a soft yip, staring at the rocks above them, then huffed and nipped at Chayda's wrist. Wary, Chayda stood and, silent as a scarab, climbed the rocks, gained their flattened top, and crawled to the far lip. On the sand below, 100 paces distant, 3 skiffs huddled behind a cluster of stones. 3 women and a man with a long, sandy beard stood nearby. They watched the horizon, where the tips of the yacht's masts could still be seen wavering in the heat.
4 to man 3 skiffs, Chayda thought. There must be more crew.
The typical minimum was 2 to a skiff, but given how much gear she saw inside the hulls, likely 12 had come. The footprints she saw heading away from the ships confirmed her fears. She'd grown out of practice with feeling for the hearts of those around her. She tried now, clumsily, and realized too late there were others nearby, some working their way around the bulk of the rock she lay upon.
Stand, came a voice behind her. Slowly.
She stood and turned to find a woman and a man only a few paces away, both holding shamshirs. Chayda lifted her hands in peace as the stiff wind tugged at their amber thorbs. Their faces were hidden by the veils of their turbans, but Chayda recognized contempt when she saw it.
Your sword, the woman said. Carefully.
She wore a black turban with thread of gold embroidered throughout. The small coins adorning the fringes clinked softly in the wind.
I am not yours to command, Chayda said,
lowering her hands until they were loose at her sides.
Fool girl,
the man said, stepping forward, ready to poke her chest with the tip of his shamshir, a warning meant to draw a bit of blood if Chayda refused to comply. He did it sloppily, betting she'd be cowed, but in this he was sadly mistaken. Before his blade could touch her, she spun and slid alongside the path of his swing. He tried to recover, but she was inside his guard now and moving quickly. As he pulled his shamshir back, she gripped the blade near the hilt with one hand, his wrist with the other, and followed his movement. She guided the sword back and up, twisting beneath it and controlling him so that his body effectively blocked any advance by his female companion. She had more than enough leverage to snap his wrist or dislocate his arm, but she merely flipped him over his extended arm, taking his sword from him in the process. The woman advanced with a good deal more prudence, but Cheda wasted no time. Gripping the shamshir with both hands, she beat the woman's initial swing up, dodged when the expected downward swing came, and brought her shamshir down across the woman's sword with a mighty two-handed chop. The woman lost her grip on it, and the sword clanged loudly against the stone. Things were escalating far too quickly, but when the woman made the foolish decision to reach for her lost sword, Cheda had no choice but to hold the man's shamshir against her throat. Thankfully, she took it no further, choosing instead to stand and back away, hands raised. Without taking her eyes from them, Cheda crouched and picked up the fallen blade.
"Who are you?"
It was the woman who answered.
"You've no right to come on our land, steal our water and ask us questions."
After considering that for a moment, Cheda said,
"You're right."
She flipped both swords, one in either hand, so that she held them by the blade, then held them out. The woman accepted hers cautiously. The man leaned forward and snatched his angrily. Neither, thankfully, advanced on her. Cheda pulled the veil from her face and bowed her head to the woman.
"My name is Varain, and I've come from Sharakai. I lost my skiff to slip sand 2 weeks ago, and have been here ever since, hoping..."
She waved in the direction of the skiffs beyond the rocks.
"Well, hoping someone might come."
Karim was in the cavern, his fear for Cheda spiking.
"Vyria's grace remains silent," she bade him. "Hide deep in the cavern unless the need is great."
He was poised to howl, to come bursting forth from the tunnel's entrance. If that were to happen, blood would flow, and it likely wouldn't stop until many had fed the sands with their lives. The woman's brows pinched in a frown, but then something caught her attention, and her eyes drifted down toward the cavern's entrance. Cheda risked a glance back. Just entering the swathe of shade were a dozen men and women, dressed in similarly pale thawbs and black turbans. A few, like the woman, wore turbans with coins woven into the fabric. Others wore conical helms, with patterned scrollwork and a curtain of chainmail along the sides and back. They'd heard the clash of steel, no doubt. Now they'd spotted the wolves and were watching them warily. A few were drawing bows from their backs and stringing them. Three had broken away and were making their way toward the top of the rocks, but when the woman in the thread of gold turban held up her hand, they stopped and waited. Karim, praise the gods, remained silent as the woman regarded Cheda levelly, thankfully with more curiosity than enmity.
"And the wolves?" she asked.
"They were here when I arrived. We've been sharing the water."
"Then you won't mind if we kill a few?"
"I'd rather you didn't."
The woman considered for several heartbeats before she too removed her veil. Staring back at Cheda was a stern, weather-worn face with blue tattoos marking her cheeks, forehead and nose. She sheathed her sword and motioned the man to do the same. She kept her right hand on the hilt of her shamshir, however, a warning that in the desert, trust was a commodity bought with truths.
"How does a blade maiden find herself in the lands of tribe Salmuk?"
"I am no maiden."
A simple enough statement and true.
"I stole both the dress and the blade."
"The maidens are hardly in the business of misplacing their dresses, and even less of losing their blades."
"True, but nor do they complain much when their blood has fed the Great Mother."
The woman's eyebrows rose as she glanced at the man beside her.
"You expect me to believe you killed a blade maiden?"
"I do."
Chayda watched carefully for their reactions, especially the woman's. Chayda had two choices for how to proceed, either to mark herself as an enemy of the king's or not. Depending on the loyalties of Tribe Salmuk, or at least the band gathered around her, she might be choosing wrongly, but she suspected not. The way the woman had reacted to her claim of killing a maiden had smacked of being impressed.
"Perhaps by now," Chayda went on, "word of a battle in Sharakai has reached your tents. I took part in it. I fought the maidens and the kings."
The woman jutted her chin toward the horizon where the yacht had disappeared.
"That ship was searching for you, then?"
Chayda nodded.
"They've been chasing me for weeks."
The tattoos at the corners of the woman's eyes pinched as she took in Chayda anew.
"You're a scarab."
A scarab of the moonless host, she meant. A soldier in the fight to bring down the kings.
"No,"
Chayda replied,
"but our interests align."
As the woman turned to the man, something changed below. Thorn emitted a low growl and was moving toward the nearest of the desert folk, a man who held a bow with an arrow nocked and sighted. Chayda whistled sharply, urgently, and thankfully, Thorn went silent and slinked away. The woman took this in, one eyebrow raised.
"They were here when you arrived, you said."
Chayda shrugged.
"We've come to an accord."
Now both her eyebrows rose and she laughed.
"I dare say."
She weighed up Chayda for a moment.
"You'll remain here."
And with that she headed down along the sloped stone, motioning the men to follow. When they reached the other desert folk, they spoke together for a time, softly enough that the strong wind hid their conversation despite the adikara petals Chayda had taken. The woman was doing most of the talking. Now and again some of them would look up toward her. The man at one point gesticulated wildly to the north, the place where Tribe Salmuk was gathered, perhaps. When the conversation died, the woman waved Chayda to approach, and Chayda made her way down to the level stone beyond the cavern entrance, her heart pounding so strongly it was sending Karim's fear to new heights.
"Stay," Chayda said as calmly as she could manage. "All is well."
She heard his soft moan from the cavern's entrance, but luckily no one else did, mixing as it did with the sigh of the wind. When Chayda came to a stop before the gathered tribesmen, the woman clasped her hands before her and bowed her head, a gesture of peace in the desert, a gesture Chayda quickly mirrored.
"My name is Beryl," she said, "and you are welcome in our lands. Our sheikh is only a day's sail distant. I hope you'll come to speak with him."
She looked Chayda up and down.
"I suspect you could use the food, and we could use tales of the city."
"A trade, then?"
Chayda asked. The woman named Beryl tilted her head in acknowledgement, but not without a wry smile.
"A trade."
Chayda couldn't remain out here with a pack of wolves and live on lizards and beetles forever. Accepting Beryl's offer would mean that she would be parted from Karim, at least temporarily. But it couldn't be helped. She had spent these weeks in the desert waiting for the dust to settle in the city, using that time to learn more about Misut's bracelet to free the souls within. But the time had come to move on. She had to return to Sharakai, and soon. There was so much to do, not the least of which was learning more about the bonds that chained the Esirim. In Karim, she had found one who could resist the call of the kings. Might she find more? Might she be able to help them break their bonds once and for all? It must be so. They had been weakening for centuries. She just had to find a way to exploit it. And there was the silver trove to consider.
the thing she felt certain her mother had gone to find the night before she had been captured and killed by the kings. Dardzada, her foster father, had thought it a mirage. In the end, her mother had too, but Chayda would know the truth of it. She had to try to retrace her mother's steps on Toriat that night. Lastly, there were the Blade Maidens. She needed allies, and what better way to gain them than by turning one of the king's greatest strengths to her advantage? There was Zaid, but the time had come to try to gain more, to convince others outside the 13th tribe that the king's story of the Asurum being holy warriors who had sacrificed themselves on the night of Bet Iman had always been a grand, sickening ruse. Still, this was no easy decision. Would Beryl's sheikh be friend or foe? In her time with the Blade Maidens, she'd learned much of Sheikh Hisham, the leader of tribe Samuk, these past 30 years. He was petty and fought the neighboring tribes fiercely, wielding his control over access to the trading paths to Malasan like a cudgel. Still, he had no great love for the kings of Sharakai. He likely wouldn't turn her in for ransom, not without hearing her tale and weighing what she might have to offer his tribe. He might even supply her with a skiff.
"Very well," Chayda said. "I will gather my things."
And so Chayda did. The desert folk went to the underground cavern and filled bladders with water. Kirim, blessedly, had retreated deep into the darkness. She could feel his long, quieted anger awakening once more, as if the presence of strangers had rekindled that most inescapable part of being an Aesir, hunger for the blood of mortal man.
"You've held it at bay for this long," she told him. "It will keep a while longer. Stay where you are, Kirim, but be ready to follow once we've left."
Soon Chayda was led to the skiffs hidden among the rocks. The wolves followed her for a time, Mist padding ahead of the others, yipping and jumping occasionally as if she wanted to play. Chayda knew that wasn't it, though. Of course it wasn't. Chayda scrubbed the fur behind the wolf's ears, then knelt and hugged her, digging her fingers deep into Mist's grey mane.
"We'll see one another again,"
she said, kissing the wolf on the muzzle. Then she whispered,
"Thank you for saving me."
They left soon after, sailing away across the sand, Mist watching long after the other wolves had peeled away. Soon she had shrunk into the distance, becoming lost altogether as clusters of rocks intervened. They sailed for the entire day, the crew strangely silent. They watched the horizon intently, wary of the royal yacht, perhaps, or rival tribes.
"I've heard tales of Hisham," Chayda said as they ate flatbread laced with onion and leek. "They've all said he's a good man, a just leader."
Everyone in the skiff stiffened, sending sly glances at one another, all but Beryl, who held Chayda's eye with a steady gaze.
"Hisham is dead."
Chayda felt as if the sands were shifting beneath her feet.
"My tears for your loss," she said, making sure to meet every grim eye turned toward her.
Hisham was childless, which might have put the succession of the tribe in question. Did that explain their tenseness?
"Who leads your tribe now?"
"You'll see soon enough," Beryl replied.
From that point on, the tone of the voyage shifted. Chayda no longer felt like a guest, nor even an interloper on their lands, but a prisoner. Her immediate thought was to run or to fight if necessary. With Kirim, who followed a good distance behind the skiffs, she stood a good chance. But if she were to survive out here in the desert, she needed to know more about the tribes.
She would see this man, this sheikh, and see what he was about. Near nightfall, a cluster of ships seemed to lift along the horizon. They'd gathered by a large outcropping of stone that looked like a chipped axe head sticking out of the sand. As they came closer, groupings of tents were revealed. Three horses were tied to stakes near the largest ship. People moved about. A fire blazed at the center of the camp. As their skiff approached, Beryl motioned to Chader's belt.
"I'll take your sword until you've spoken with our sheikh."
The others watched, ready. What could Chader do? She'd known they would ask, and yet the idea of giving up River's daughter, the very symbol of a blade maiden, so repulsed her, she considered challenging Beryl to take it from her. But the sheikh had no reason to do her harm. If she were careful, she should be able to gain his trust, a thing that would be impossible were she to resist. So she slipped the sword from her belt, scabbard and all, and handed it to Beryl, who nodded sharply, relief clear on her hardened face. After they had anchored near the larger ships, Beryl entered one of the largest of the tents near the fire, taking Chader's sword with her. After a time she stepped out, waved, and Chader was led toward the tent, accompanied by four of the desert folk. None had hands on weapons, but they watched Chader carefully from the corners of their eyes. Many took note of her arrival. Men, women, and children, some preparing food, others working the ships. Most stared with mistrust in their eyes. Those who hadn't noticed Chader or weren't interested in the new arrival seemed joyless, burdened even in the menial tasks of mixing dough for flatbread, grooming horses or tending to the ships.
"When did your most gracious lord Hisham die?" Chader asked.
It was the only explanation she could think of for the strange mood. The man walking by her side did not reply. He merely led Chader along with the others toward the large tent. All around them, the hands at work seemed to slow. All eyes turned to her. In the desert, she felt Karim. A spike of fear burned suddenly inside his heart, mere moments before a hulking mass lumbered out of the tent. He was a beast of a man, a head and a half taller than Chader, arms like haunches of meat, legs like tree trunks. He wore black armor that might once have been fine but was now nicked, rusted in places, torn near one shoulder so that it hung not quite right on his meaty frame. His black hair was matted to his forehead and cheeks, framing humorless, deep-set eyes that gave him the look of one of the terrible hyenas, the black laughers that roamed the desert. She knew now why the tribe had acted the way it did, and why fear now filled Karim's heart. For Onur, the feasting king, the king of spears, stood before her, grinning as if he'd just found his next meal. Chapter 2. From a dark alley in Sharakai's cramped West End, Emre studied a window across the street, three stories up, where an old man was methodically setting pistachio shells down into a slowly growing pile. His hands would disappear into the shadows of the room, then reappear in a flash of sunlight with fresh shells, the rhythm revealing how deft he was at shelling the nuts.
"Oh, how bloody hungry he is," Emre thought.
Frail Lamai stood behind Emre, leaning his colossal frame against the mud brick wall behind him. He cracked his knuckles loudly.
"Time to go up, Emre."
"Not yet, Lamai. Quiet down."
"I know. You said it. It's just..."
He looked up and down the street, a flash of fear showing on a stark face that all too often projected anger and threat and little else.
"I hate being out like this," he said,
feel like a fucking lamb waiting for the slaughter. You know?
I know, Lem. I want to make sure we're not walking into a trap.
Frère Lemai hardly seemed to hear him.
I'm no lamb, Emre.
I know, Lem.
Shifting his weight, Lemai cracked his neck and glared up and down the street.
No fucking lamb.
Emre kept watching the building. Its windows, the roofline, the alleys. Not many walked this street in the shallows, and those who did knew it didn't pay to linger. It had only been 4 weeks since the battle at the harbour, a night the entire city now referred to as Bet Savash, the night of endless swords. Not much time in the grand scheme of things, but Emre was sure the hunt would continue for months, day by day putting more pressure on the resistance, known as the Moonless Host. There wasn't a night that passed where Emre didn't hear of someone new found hung at the gates of Turiat, or face down in the dry bed of the Hadar, or dragged away for an intimate chat with the Confessor King. He was sure one day he'd return to the hovel he shared with Frère Lemai to find a squad of silver spears waiting for them, or hear that Maseed, leader of the Moonless Host, had been killed, having miraculously and perhaps foolishly remained in the city after his father, Ishak, had returned to the desert. Two children ran along the street, each waving a dusty green streamer behind them. It made Emre feel foolish.
Is this what it's come to? Quaking at the sight of empty streets, seeing ghosts in empty doorways.
Come on, Lem. Time to speak to the man.
Despite his bravado, Emre felt as if an arrow were being aimed between his shoulder blades as they crossed the street and entered the squat, mud-brick building. It made his skin itch. As he passed into shade and the breeze flowed along the shade-cooled hallway, he shrugged his shoulders in a vain attempt to ease the feeling. It made his skin itch even more, made him feel a bit of a coward to boot. He turned and groused Lemai.
Stop stepping on my heels, will you?
Frère Lemai looked down, confused.
He hadn't stepped on Emre's heels,
but looked chagrined as though he had.
Sorry, Emre, I didn't...
Just give me some space, you're breathing down my neck.
Sorry, Emre.
Emre felt like a jackass, but said nothing as they took the stairs up to the third floor and walked past a dozen doorways. A month ago, these doorways would have been open to allow the breeze to blow through, but today they were all covered by rugs or blankets, all but the last, which was their destination.
Galieu,
he said when he reached the open doorway. Across the room, in a chair beside the window, a wizened old man sat with a pile of pistachios in his lap. With practiced ease, he took one of the pistachios, split it using an empty shell, and popped the pale green nut into his mouth.
Emre,
Galieu said, chewing. As he spoke, he didn't look toward Emre, nor did he look toward the growing pile on the windowsill as he set another pair of empty shells atop it. He was blind or near enough that it made no difference. On a pallet in the corner rested a lone boy, 12, maybe 13 years old. The rest of the narrow pallets, 15 in all, lay empty, bedrolls placed neatly at the head of each.
One!
Emre exclaimed, wondering what Maseed was going to say. The last time Emre had come here, he had been paying Galieu to gather volunteers to join the Moonless Host. It had been shortly before the Night of Endless Swords, a night that had seen two of the king's caches of life-giving elixirs destroyed. Emre himself, along with Maseed, Ramad, Amansir, and Meriem, the Queen of Mireia herself, had gone to Eventide, the palace of Kiral, the King of Kings, where they'd destroyed his cache, while their brother and sister Scarabs had done the same to the one in Isan's palace.
The third, Zahebs, had been found by the forces of the blood mage, Ham Zakir, before the moonless host arrived. Ham Zakir's men had stolen the elixirs, so between them they had robbed the kings of the bulk of their magical drafts, while at the same time shifting a good deal of power to Ham Zakir. It was a disturbing outcome, to say the least. Ham Zakir had posed as an ally to Ishak and his son Masid, but had soon betrayed their trust, using his power to siphon off much of the support the Moonless Host received from the sheikhs of the desert tribes and other powerful people in Sharakai. In the days before Ham Zakir's arrival, the Moonless Host had been beset with trouble, but at least its ranks had been filled with optimism. Now, though, Emre stared at the boy on the pallet, sizing him up anew.
Is this what we've come to?
One lone, brave boy has answered our call. Leaning against the crumbling brick wall, legs pulled to his chest, the boy looked small and fragile, and that in turn made this whole endeavor feel like a house of sand ready to crumble the moment the desert winds came howling. Galieux chuckled at Emre's reaction.
You expected an army. I expected more brave souls to stand up. Perhaps the souls of this city aren't quite as brave as you thought.
Emre glanced back at Frère Lamai, who merely shrugged.
One, Emre thought. One to add to our cause. You told them the new reward.
Galieux waggled his head.
I did, but they might be worried about you paying. The West End's alive with rumors that it's not Masid who has the money, but someone else.
Ham Zakir.
He meant Ham Zakir, who was vying for the hearts of those sympathetic to the Moonless Host. Since dawn had risen on the night of endless swords, he'd been working steadily against Ishak and Masid, slowly driving a wedge between them and their followers, sowing seeds of doubt that they could free the downtrodden in Sharakai. He had promised money as well as protection, but unlike Masid, he had been able to deliver.
Emre dropped 10 silval into Galieux's outstretched palm and said, "Raise the price to 1 ral each."
The coins disappeared.
The price of a life in Sharakai.
Save your cheap philosophy,
Emre said, waving the boy to stand and follow Frère Lamai from the room.
Just see that it's done.
Of course,
Galieux said as he gathered up the last of the nuts and dropped them into a cloth sack between his feet. He had kept one in his hand, which he split and ate, but then he did something strange. He placed the shell on the windowsill, but it slipped off the edge, a thing he had been careful never to do. Until now. Emre spun around, suddenly wary. From the hallway, he heard the clash of a cymbal ringing over and over. It came from the open window as well, the sound rebounding off the mud brick buildings. It sounded as if it were coming from their building. Lamai was leaning out of the doorway, looking down the hall. The boy had inched toward him, and when he saw that Lamai wasn't watching, he burst into motion, a knife suddenly raised in one hand.
Lamai!
Frère Lamai turned in time to see the boy rushing him. He tried to shy away from the knife, but he'd only managed to take one step back when the boy lunged and drove the tip of the knife into Lamai's chest. The next moment, Lamai had grabbed the boy's wrist and wrenched it upward. The boy cried out, and the knife clattered to the floor. Then, in a blur of movement, Lamai lifted him like a sack of flour and drove him down into the dry, wooden planks. The impact shook the walls. The sound was like the strike of a battering ram.
The boy curled up like a fiddlehead as he fought to regain his breath. In that moment, Frail Lamai grabbed the blood-slicked knife.
No!
The boy gasped.
I had to!
But that was all he had a chance to say before the knife blurred and landed with a thump over his heart. He went stiff all over and gripped Frail Lamai's wrist, mouth agape in a silent plea to the gods for kindness in his final moments. Emery turned on Galieux as he heard the stomp of boots along the hallway. In a flash of anger, he drew his shamshir.
I name you traitor to the Al-Afwa Kadal!
Galieux, who looked strangely pensive, stared straight ahead.
Depends on who you think is leading the Al-Afwa Kadal.
Emery felt a white-hot rage burning inside him. He meant Hamza Kia. Galieux, one of Ishak's oldest soldiers in Sharakai, had somehow been turned as well. With one swift stroke, Emre swung his sword across Galieux's neck, knocking him back off his chair and onto the dusty floor, blood spurting from the gash. Pools of his blood collected along the dirty floor, turning it the colour of a dusty rose. A woman's voice bellowed along the hall.
In the name of the kings of Sharakai, lay down your arms!
Frail Lamai stood at the door, his sword in hand, blood flowing down his chest. In another man, such blood loss would seriously hinder him, but not Lamai. He stood, ready to fight, his eyes feral as they searched for a way out. Emre moved toward the window to see how many might be waiting below, but the moment he went near it, a black arrow streaked into the room. It caught him with a searing burn across his right arm. He'd only just managed to duck away as three more flew in, all from different angles. Emery shook his head at Frail Lamai, whose eyes hardened.
I'm no fucking lamb, Emery.
No, Emery said. Neither am I.
He'd rather die than sit with the Confessor King. But what could they do? Both exits were blocked. The call came again.
Lay down your arms!
And now Emery could see her, a maiden in her black fighting dress, veil and buckler, the ebon blade in her right hand making her look like a revenant come for its due. There were two more behind her, and a line of silver spears behind them. Emery looked to the window, to dying Galieux, to the boy who now lay lifeless. As Frail Lamai engaged the maiden and the ring of steel made this already small space feel smaller, a grapnel swung up and hooked over the windowsill. Pistachio shells scattered everywhere. Drawing his knife, Emery rushed forward, careful to stay out of sight of the bowman. He took a chance, trying to reach out and cut the rope, but the moment he did, an arrow punched through the meat of his forearm, sinking into the wood of the window frame. Gritting his teeth against the pain, he gripped the shaft of the arrow and pulled up in a sharp, violent arc. The shaft snapped as the rope was cut. Blood streamed down his arm as more arrows thudded into the floor. He'd seen in that split moment how many there were outside. A pair of maidens and a dozen silver spears. He sat near the window, his back against the wall. With a terrible spasm of pain, he yanked what remained of the arrow shaft free of his arm. He shut his eyes as the pain peaked. When he opened them once more, he noticed the state of disrepair in the corner of the room, how badly the bricks were crumbling, and a mad, desperate thought occurred to him. Rising to a crouch, he shifted closer to the door. Only an arm's reach away, Frail Lamai bellowed with rage as his sword flashed, defending against the maiden's incredible speed. Emre ignored the fight and ran at the wall, powering one shoulder against it. Something crunched in his shoulder. Bits of the mud brick flaked away, but the wall held. Frail Lamai, retreating into the room, glanced back. His eyes went wide like a child who'd been shown a card trick for the first time. In unspoken concert, he nodded as Emre picked up one of the heavy wooden pallets. Emre's arm burned from the bloody arrow wound, and his shoulder felt as though the bones were being pulverized, but he managed to lift the pallet and run toward the open doorway as Frau Lamai launched three hard, precise blows against the maiden's defenses and backed away. Emre drove forward with the pallet, shoving it hard against the blade maiden as she tried to enter the room. She was caught off guard, forced back by the massive hunk of wood driving toward her. She braced herself, but too late. Emre shoved her into the hall, crowding those behind her as well. As Emre picked up his fallen sword, Frau Lamai drove into the wall like a charging Akala stallion. The entire face of the wall caved inward, a wooden beam cracking in two as Frau Lamai, bricks, and a cloud of dust broke through to a small living space on the opposite side. The support above the wall gave a bit, and more bricks crumbled down into both rooms. From the floor above, the muffled sound of an old woman's voice shouting in Kundanese filtered down. A family of five cowered in the room beyond, staring wide-eyed at Frau Lamai and the hole in the wall of their one-room home. As the maiden threw the pallet aside and made for him, Emre charged another of the exposed wooden supports. It was dry as bone and hardly thicker than his arm. He rammed it with his good shoulder, praying to Rhea for kindness. As the maiden sliced an arc through the air with her ebon blade, Emre met the support. It splintered as he crashed into it, and the floor above began to rain down. The maiden tried to follow, tried to get beyond the falling debris to reach Emre, but Frau Lamai had stood and picked up a heavy iron cooking pot. He swung it by the handle and brought it down with all his might against the maiden's head. She tried to roll away, but it caught her along the top of her skull with a crunch that was swallowed by the growing stream of debris falling from the floors above. Emre headed for the open doorway, but Frau Lamai was just standing there, staring at the maiden's form, his eyes afire.
"Quickly!"
Emre hissed, grabbing Frau Lamai's arm and pulling him toward the open doorway.
"Lamai, quick or we're both dead!"
He wasn't sure Frau Lamai had heard him, but a moment later, Lamai's eyes turned to his. The fire in them faded a bit, and he looked around at the ruin they had created. Then a bit of fear returned, and they sped off, into the hall, following a rush of fleeing men and women and children. Most probably didn't know what they were running from. Few bothered to look back. They just ran, sensing that to remain would be to die. The Shallows had a way of instilling such instincts. When they came to a set of stairs, Frau Lamai was about to follow the rush, but Emre grabbed his arm.
"This way,"
he said, guiding him to a nearby room. It had a small stove at its center, with warm bread spread around it, abandoned in the panic. On the far side of the room was a window, and beyond, a space only wide enough for a man to slip along sideways, a victim of the slapdash planning that plagued the Shallows. They were three stories up, but the closeness of the buildings was an asset here. Emre slipped into the gap, one foot on the wall ahead of him, his back against the opposite wall. Bracing himself between the two, he slid slowly down, scraping painfully at times in his haste to reach solid ground. Frau Lamai came after. When they struck dirt, they sidled quickly along, then squeezed themselves through the narrow gap at the end to reach one of the hundreds of nondescript alleys in the Shallows. They ran, further and further away. The more distance they put between themselves and Goliath's building, though, the more disconsolate Frau Lamai became.
"He was just a kid, Emre. Why do you have to take a knife to me like that?"
I don't know, Lem. Things are changing in this city.
Frau Lemai